content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the New Yorker Hour on North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. I'm Evan Mercer, and today, from the July 8, 2019 edition of the New Yorker magazine, I will read an article about women's suffrage turning 100. But first, I will conclude our celebration of another anniversary, Walt Whitman's birth on Long Island 200 years ago, by reading Song of Myself, which has been said to represent, quote, the core of Whitman's poetic vision. We'll begin with Song of Myself by Walt Whitman, published in 1855. 1. I celebrate myself and sing myself, and what I assume, you shall assume, for every atom belonging to me, as good belongs to you. I loaf and invite my soul. I lean and loaf at my ease, observing a spear of summer grass. My tongue, every atom of my blood, formed from this soil, this air, born here of parents, born here from parents the same, and their parents the same. I, now 37 years old, in perfect health begin, hoping to cease not till death. Creeds and schools in abeyance, retiring back a while, sufficed at what they are, but never forgotten. I harbor for good or bad. I permit to speak at every hazard. Nature without check, with original energy. 2. Houses and rooms are full of perfumes. The shelves are crowded with perfumes. I breathe the fragrance myself, and know it and like it. The distillation would intoxicate me also, but I shall not let it. The atmosphere is not a perfume. It has no taste of the distillation. It is odorless. It is for my mouth forever. I am in love with it. I will go to the bank by the wood and become undisguised and naked. I am mad for it to be in contact with me. The smoke of my own breath echoes, ripples, buzzed whispers, love root, silk thread, crotch and vine, my inspiration and respiration, the beating of my heart, the passing of blood and air through my lungs, the sniff of green leaves and dry leaves, and of the shore and dark-colored sea rocks, and of hay in the barn, the sound of the belched words of my voice loosed to the eddies of the wind, a few light kisses, a few embraces, a reaching around of arms, the play of shine and shade on the trees as the supple boughs wag, the delight alone or in the rush of the streets or along the fields and hillsides, the feeling of health, the full noon trill, the song of me rising from bed and meeting the sun. Have you reckoned 1,000 acres much? Have you reckoned the earth much? Have you practiced so long to learn to read? Have you felt so proud to get at the meaning of poems? Stop this day and night with me, and you shall possess the origin of all poems. You shall possess the good of the earth and sun. There are millions of suns left. You shall no longer take things at second or third hand, nor look through the eyes of the dead, nor feed on the specters in books. You shall not look through my eyes either, nor take things from me. You shall listen to all sides and filter them from yourself. 3. I have heard what the talkers were talking, the talk of the beginning and the end. But I do not talk of the beginning or the end. There was never any more inception than there is now, nor any more youth or age than there is now, and will never be any more perfection than there is now, nor any more heaven or hell than there is now. Urge and urge and urge, always the procreant urge of the world. Out of the dimness, opposite equals advance. Always substance and increase, always sex, always a knit of identity, always distinction, always a breed of life. To elaborate is no avail. learned and unlearned feel that it is so. Sure as the most certain sure, plumb in the uprights, well entreated, braced in the beams, stout as a horse, affectionate, haughty, electrical, I and this mystery, here we stand. Clear and sweet is my soul, and clear and sweet is all that is not my soul. Lack one, lacks both, and the unseen is proved by the seen, till that becomes unseen and receives proof in its turn. Showing the best and dividing it from the worst age vexes age. Knowing the perfect fitness and equanimity of things, while they discuss, I am silent and go bathe myself and admire myself. Welcome is every organ an attribute of me, and of any man hearty and clean. Not an inch nor a particle of an inch is vile, and none shall be less familiar than the rest. I am satisfied. I see, dance, laugh, sing, as the hugging and loving bedfellow sleeps at my side through the night and withdraws at the peep of the day with stealthy tread, leaving me baskets covered with white towels, swelling the house with their plenty. Shall I postpone my acceptation and realization and scream at my eyes, that they turn from gazing after and down the road, and forthwith cipher and show me to assent exactly the value of one and exactly the value of two, and which is ahead? 4. Trippers and askers surround me. People I meet, the effect upon me of my early life, or the ward and city I live in, or the nation. The latest dates, discoveries, inventions, societies, authors old and new. My dinner, dress, associates, looks, compliments, dues. The real or fancied indifference of some man or woman I love. The sickness of one of my folks, or of myself, or ill-doing or loss or lack of money, or depressions or exaltations. Battles, the horrors of fratricidal war, the fever of doubtful news, the fitful events. These come to me days and nights and go from me again, but they are not the me, myself. Apart from the pulling and hauling stands what I am, stands amused, complacent, compassionating, idle, unitary, looks down, is erect, or bends an arm or an impalpable certain rest, looking with side-curved head, curious what will come next, both in and out of the game, and watching and wondering at it. Backward I see in my own days where I sweated through fog with linguists and contenders. I have no mockings or arguments. I witness and wait. 5. I believe in you, my soul. The other I am must not abase itself to you, and you must not be abased to the other. Loaf with me on the grass, loose the stop from your throat. Not words, not music or rhyme I want, not custom or lecture, not even the best. Only the lull I like, the hum of your velvet voice. I mind how once we lay such a transparent summer morning, how you settled your head athwart my hips and gently turned over upon me, and parted the shirt from my bosom bone, and pledged your tongue to my bare-stripped heart, and reached till you felt my beard, and reached till you held my feet. Swiftly arose and spread around me the peace and knowledge that pass all the argument of the earth. And I know that the hand of God is the promise of my own. And I know that the Spirit of God is the brother of my own. And that all the men ever born are also my brothers, and the women my sisters and lovers. And that a kelson of the creation is love. And limitless are leaves stiff or drooping in the fields, and brown ants in the little wells beneath them, and mossy scabs of the worm fence, heaped stones, elder, malign, and pokeweed. 6. A child said, "What is the grass?" fetching it to me with full hands. How could I answer the child? I do not know what it is any more than he. I guess it must be the flag of my disposition, out of hopeful green stuff woven. Or I guess it is the handkerchief of the Lord, a scented gift and remembrancer designedly dropped, bearing the owner's name some way in the corners, that we may see and remark and say, "Whose?" Or I guess the grass is itself a child, the produced babe of the vegetation. Or I guess it is a uniform hieroglyphic, and it means sprouting alike in broad zones and narrow zones, growing among black folks as among white. Canuck, Tuckahoe, Congressman, Cuff, I give them the same. I receive them the same. And now it seems to me the beautiful uncut hair of graves. Tenderly will I use you, curling grass. It may be you transpire from the breasts of young men. It may be if I had known them, I would have loved them. It may be you are from old people, or from offspring taken soon out of their mother's laps. And here you are the mother's laps. This grass is very dark to be from the white heads of old mothers, darker than the colorless beards of old men, dark to come from under the faint red roofs of mouths. Oh, I perceive, after all, so many uttering tongues, and I perceive they do not come from the roofs of mouths for nothing. I wish I could translate the hints about the dead young men and women, and the hints about old men and mothers, and the offspring taken soon out of their laps. What do you think has become of the young and old men? And what do you think has become of the women and children? They are alive and well somewhere. The smallest sprout shows there is really no death, and if ever there was, it led forward life, and does not wait at the end to arrest it, and ceased the moment life appeared. All goes onward and outward. Nothing collapses. And to die is different from what anyone supposed, and luckier. 7. Has anyone supposed it lucky to be born? I hasten to inform him or her it is just as lucky to die, and I know it. I pass death with the dying and birth with the new washed babe, and am not contained between my hats and bones, and peruse manifold objects, no two alike, and every one good, the earth good and the stars good and their adjuncts all good. I am not an earth nor an adjunct of an earth. I am the mate and companion of people, all just as immortal and fathomless as myself. They do not know how immortal, but I know. Every kind for itself and its own, for me, mine male and female, for me, those that have been boys and that love women, for me, the man that is proud and feels how it stings to be slighted, for me, the sweetheart and the old maid, for me, mothers and the mothers of mothers, for me, lips that have smiled, eyes that have shed tears, for me, children and the begetters of children. Undrape! You are not guilty to me, nor stale, nor discarded. I see through the broadcloth and gingham whether or no, and am around, tenacious, acquisitive, tireless, and cannot be shaken away. 8. The little one sleeps in its cradle. I lift the gauze and look a long time, and silently brush away flies with my hand. The youngster and the red-faced girl turn aside up the bushy hill. I peeringly view them from the top. The suicide sprawls on the bloody floor of the bedroom. I witness the corpse with its dabbled hair. I note where the pistol has fallen. The blab of the pave, tires of carts, slough of boot soles, talk of the promenaders, the heavy omnibus, the driver with his interrogating thumb, the clank of the shod horses on the granite floor, the snow sleighs, clinking, shouted jokes, pelts of snowballs, the hurrahs for popular favorites, the fury of roused mobs, the flap of the curtained litter, a sick man inside borne to the hospital, the meeting of enemies, the sudden oath, the blows and fall, the excited crowd, the policeman with his star quickly working his passage to the center of the crowd, the impassive stones that receive and return so many echoes. What groans of overfed or half-starved who fall unstruck, who fall sunstruck or in fits. What exclamations of women taken suddenly who hurry home and give birth to babes. What living and buried speech is always vibrating here. What howls restrained by decorum. Arrests of criminals, slights, adulterous offers made, acceptances, rejections with convex lips. I mind them, or the show of residence of them. I come, and I depart. 9. The big doors of the country barn stand open and ready. The dried grass of the harvest time loads the slow-drawn wagon. The clear light plays on the brown, gray, and green intertinged. The armfuls are packed to the sagging mow. I am there. I help. I came stretched atop of the load. I felt its soft jolts, one leg reclined on the other. I jump from the crossbeams and seize the clover and timothy, and roll head over heels and tangle my hair full of wisps. 10. Alone, far in the wilds and mountains I hunt, wandering amazed at my own lightness and glee. In the late afternoon, choosing a safe spot to pass the night, kindling a fire and broiling the fresh-killed game, falling asleep on the gathered leaves with my dog and gun by my side. The Yankee Clipper is under her sky sails. She cuts the sparkle and scud. My eyes settle to land. I bend at her prow or shout joyously from the deck. The boatman and clam diggers arose early and stopped for me. I tucked my trouser ends in my boots and went and had a good time. You should have been with us that day round the chowder kettle. I saw the marriage of the trapper in the open air in the far west. The bride was a red girl. Her father and his friends sat near cross-legged and dumbly smoking. They had moccasins to their feet and large thick blankets hanging from their shoulders. On a bank lounged the trapper. He was dressed mostly in skins. His luxuriant beard and curls protected his neck. He held his bride by the hand. She had long eyelashes. Her head was bare. Her coarse, straight locks descended upon her voluptuous limbs and reached to her feet. The runaway slave came to my house and stopped outside. I heard his motions crackling the twigs of the woodpile. Through the swung half-door of the kitchen, I saw him limpsy and weak, and went where he sat on a log and let him in and assured him, and brought water and filled a tub for his sweated body and bruised feet, and gave him a room that entered from my own, and gave him some coarse, clean clothes, and remember perfectly well his revolving eyes and his awkwardness, and remember putting plasters on the galls of his neck and ankles. He stayed with me a week before he was recuperated and passed north. I had him sit next to me at the table. My firelock leaned in the corner. 11. 28 young men bathe by the shore. 28 young men and all so friendly. 28 years of womanly life and all so lonesome. She owns the fine house by the rise of the bank. She hides handsome and richly dressed aft the blinds of the window. Which of the young men does she like the best? Ah, the homeliest of them is beautiful to her. Where are you off to, lady? For I see you. You splash in the water there, yet stay stock still in your room. Dancing and laughing along the beach came the 29th bather. The rest did not see her, but she saw them and loved them. The beards of the young men glistened with wet. It ran from their long hair. Little streams passed over all their bodies. An unseen hand also passed over their bodies. It descended tremblingly from their temples and ribs. The young men float on their backs. Their white bellies bulge to the sun. They do not ask who seizes fast to them. They do not know who puffs and declines with pendant and bending arch. They do not think whom they souse with spray. 12. The butcher boy puts off his killing clothes or sharpens his knife at the stall in the market. I loiter, enjoying his repartee and his shuffle and breakdown. Blacksmiths with grimed and hairy chests environ the anvil. Each has his main sledge. They are all out. There is a great heat in the fire. From the cinder-strewed threshold, I follow their movements. The lithe sheer of their waists plays even with their massive arms. Overhand, the hammers swing. Overhand, so slow. Overhand, so sure. They do not hasten. Each man hits in his place. 13. The Negro holds firmly the reins of his four horses. The block swags underneath on its tied-over chain. The Negro that drives the long dray of the stone yard, steady and tall he stands, poised on one leg on the string piece. His blue shirt exposes his ample neck and breast and loosens over his hip band. His glance is calm and commanding. He tosses the slouch of his hat away from his forehead. The sun falls on his crispy hair and mustache, falls on the black of his polished and perfect limbs. I behold the picturesque giant and love him. And I do not stop there. I go with the team also. In me, the caresser of life, wherever moving, backward as well as forward slewing, to niches aside and junior bending, not a person or object missing, absorbing all to myself and for this song. Oxen that rattle the yoke and chain or halt in the leafy shade, what is it that you express in your eyes? It seems to me more than all the print I have read in my life. My tread scares the wood drake and wood duck on my distant and day-long ramble. They rise together. They slowly circle round. I believe in those winged purposes and acknowledge red, yellow, white playing within me and consider green and violet and the tufted crown intentional and do not call the tortoise unworthy because she is not something else. And the jay in the woods never studied the gamut, yet trills pretty well to me, and the look of the bay mare shames silliness out of me. 14. The wild gander leads his flock through the cool night. Ya honk, he says, and the sounds it down to me like an invitation. The pert may suppose it meaningless, but I, listening close, find its purpose and place up there toward the wintry sky. The sharp-hoofed moose of the north, the cat on the house sill, the chickadee, the prairie dog, the litter of the grunting sow as they tug at her teats, the brood of the turkey hen and she with her half-spread wings, I see in them and myself the same old law. The press of my foot to the earth springs 100 affections. They scorn the best I can do to relate them. I am enamored of growing outdoors, of men that live among cattle or taste of the ocean or woods, of the builders and steerers of ships and the wielders of axes and mauls and the drivers of horses. I can eat and sleep with them week in and week out. What is the commonest, cheapest, nearest, easiest is me. me going in for my chances, spending for vast returns, adorning myself to bestow myself on that first that will take me, not asking the sky to come down to my goodwill, scattering it freely forever. 15. The pure contralto sings in the organ loft. The carpenter dresses his plank. The tongue of his foreplane whistles its wild ascending lisp. The married and unmarried children ride home to their Thanksgiving dinner. The pilot seizes the kingpin. He heaves down with a strong arm. The mate stands braced in the whaleboat. Lance and harpoon are ready. The duck shooter walks by silent and cautious stretches. The deacons are ordained with crossed hands at the altar. The spinning girl retreats and advances to the hum of the big wheel. The farmer stops by the bars as he walks on a first day loaf and looks at the oats and rye. The lunatic is carried at last to the asylum, a confirmed case. He will never sleep any more as he did in the cot in his mother's bedroom. The jour printer with gray head and gaunt jaws works at his case. He turns his quid of tobacco while his eyes blur with the manuscript. The malformed limbs are tied to the surgeon's table. What is removed drops horribly in a pail. The quadroon girl is sold at the auction stand. The drunkard nods by the barroom stove. The machinist rolls up his sleeves. The policeman travels his beat. The gatekeeper marks who pass. The young fellow drives the express wagon. I love him, though I do not know him. The half-breed straps on his light boots to compete in the race. The western turkey shooting draws old and young. Some lean on their rifles. Some sit on logs. Out from the crowd steps the marksman, takes his position, levels his piece. The groups of newly come immigrants cover the wharf or levee. As the woolly pates hoe in the sugar field, the overseer views them from his saddle. The bugle calls in the ballroom. The gentlemen run for their partners. The dancers bow to each other. The youth lies awake in the cedar-roofed garret and harks to the musical rain. The wolverine sets traps on the creek that helps fill the Huron. The squaw, wrapped in her yellow-hemmed cloth, is offering moccasins and bead bags for sale. The connoisseur peers along the exhibition gallery with half-shut eyes bent sideways. As the deckhands make fast the steamboat, the plank is thrown for the shore-going passengers. The young sister holds out the skein while the elder sister winds it off in a ball and stops now and then for the knots. The one-year wife is recovering and happy, having a week ago born her first child. The clean-haired Yankee girl works with her sewing machine or in the factory or mill. The paving man leans on his two-handed rammer. The reporter's lead flies swiftly over the notebook. The sign painter is lettering with blue and gold. The canal boy trots on the towpath. The bookkeeper counts at his desk. The shoemaker waxes his thread. The conductor beats time for the band, and all the performers follow him. The child is baptized. The convert is making his first professions. The regatta is spread on the bay. The race is begun. How the white sails sparkle! The drover watching his drove sings out to them that would stray. The peddler sweats with his pack on his back. The purchaser higgling about the odd scent. The bride unrumples her white dress. The minute hand of the clock moves slowly. The opium eater reclines with rigid head and just opened lips. The prostitute draggles her shawl. Her bonnet bobs on her tipsy and pimpled neck. The crowd laugh at her blackguard oaths. The men jeer and wink to each other. Miserable! I do not laugh at your oaths, nor jeer you. The president, holding a cabinet council, is surrounded by the great secretaries. On the piazza walk three matrons, stately and friendly, with twined arms. The crew of the fish smack pack repeated layers of halibut in the hold. The Missourian crosses the plains, toting his wares and his cattle. As the fare collector goes through the train, he gives notice by jingling the loose change. The floor men are laying the floor. The tenors are tending the roof. The masons are calling for mortar. In single file, each shouldering his hod pass onward, the laborers. Seasons pursuing each other, the indescribable crowd is gathered. It is the fourth of the seventh month. What salutes of cannon and small arms! Seasons pursuing each other, the plower plows, the mower mows, and the winter grain falls in the ground. Off on the lakes, the pike fisher watches and waits by the hole in the frozen surface. The stumps stand thick round the clearing. The squatter strikes deep with his axe. Flat boatmen make fast towards dusk near the cottonwood or pecan trees. Coon seekers go through the regions of the Red River, or through those drained by the Tennessee, or through those of the Arkansas. Torches shine in the dark that hangs on the Chattahoochee or Altamaha. Patriarchs sit at supper with sons and grandsons and great-grandsons around them. In walls of adobe, in canvas tents, rest hunters and trappers after their day's sport. The city sleeps and the country sleeps. The living sleep for their time. The dead sleep for their time. The old husband sleeps by his wife and the young husband sleeps by his wife. And these tend inward to me and I tend outward to them. And such as it is to be, of these more or less I am. And of these, one and all, I weave the song of myself. And now, from the critics' section, Finish the Fight, the halting and imperfect, unfinished work of women's suffrage, by Casey Sepp. The crime was striking a match. Never mind that the match broke before it caught, or that the fire was already burning, 63-year-old Luzine Havemeyer was still hauled into court, one of 39 suffragists who were arrested in front of the White House on February 10, 1919. For more than 2 years, hundreds of women had been protesting there 6 days a week. They were known as the Silent Sentinels because they held their tongues while they held their banners. But starting that January, they had taken to burning Woodrow Wilson's speeches in tiny urns around Lafayette Park. And a few weeks into the new phase of pyrotechnics, they decided to burn him, too. Havemeyer did not actually throw the effigy of the 28th president into the fire, but she persisted in trying to light more kindling for the flames after the police told her to stop. It was her first protest of this kind. She had marched in a few parades, but as the wealthy widow of a sugar magnate, she had mostly been a benefactor, raising funds by exhibiting the extensive art collection, Rembrandt, El Greco, Manet, that she kept in her Upper East Side mansion. Her brush with the law scandalized her neighbors on Fifth Avenue, but it qualified her to go on a national railroad tour of women who had been arrested for the cause of women's suffrage. There were already more than enough jailbirds to fill the so-called prison special, not because the American suffragists were particularly radical, but because so many of them had been convicted of crimes as frivolous as striking matches. Disparaged as militants, the women who stood vigil in front of the White House were the first people ever to stage a protest there, and dozens of them were sent to prison. Many more were heckled or spat upon by passerby, and their banners and sashes torn to pieces by mobs, and were knocked down by the police. 70 years had passed since the Seneca Falls Convention, where hundreds of people had gathered in upstate New York to discuss the rights of women, including the right to vote. 40 years had passed since a federal amendment to the Constitution was introduced to extend the franchise to women. Suffragists had tried and failed to convince the courts that the 14th and 15th Amendments already did so. The rest of the country was unconvinced, too, and female suffrage remained a controversial cause in American politics. 100 years ago, though, the 19th Amendment finally passed both houses of the United States Congress and then went to the states for ratification. On that centennial, it is worth considering not only what these women were fighting for, but why they had to fight so hard and who exactly was fighting against them. Long before American women gained the right to vote, they lost it. Some of the first suffrage laws passed in this country stripped women of a right they had previously held. New York's voting laws, for instance, originally included mention of he or she and his or her ballot. But in 1777, the state struck the female pronouns, disenfranchising its women. Massachusetts did the same thing in 1780 and New Hampshire in 1784. After the ratification of the United States Constitution, which required states to write their own election laws, the voting rights of women were revoked everywhere except for New Jersey, where apparently everything was legal, until 1807, when the Garden State got around to ending women's suffrage, too. It's not clear how often women exercised this right, even when they had it. There are few known examples of women voting in the colonies. In fact, there is arguably only one, Lydia Chapin Taft, who voted in a town meeting in Uxbridge, Massachusetts. Taft, the widow of a legislator who owned a lot of land, was allowed a say chiefly because her husband had been the town's largest taxpayer. But in New Jersey, thousands of women voted during the 30 years when they were allowed to do so, women who owned property and were not married, that is. Married women could not own property since, under common law, they were themselves considered essentially the property of their husbands. In a sense, though, women voted in America long before there were states united or otherwise. In a fascinating new anthology, The Woman's Suffrage Movement, published by Penguin Classics, the scholar Sally Ruche Wagner extends the timeline of suffrage in this part of the world by nearly 1,000 years. She begins with the founding of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, when the Onondaga, Mohawk, Seneca, Oneida, and Cayuga nations, later joined by the Tuscarora, gathered in the land around the Great Lakes to form an egalitarian society that afforded women political power. Haudenosaunee women helped select the chiefs who together governed by council, and they had a say in matters of war and peace. Political historians have long described the Haudenosaunee Confederacy as the oldest continuously functioning democracy in the world. Wagner reminds us that those democratic principles extended to women. Regrettably, the women's suffrage movement does not include any Haudenosaunee voices, historical or contemporary, but Wagner does show how the comparative equality of these neighboring societies influenced the first generation of modern suffragists. Lucretia Mott stayed in a Seneca community while doing relief work with the Quakers. Elizabeth Cady Stanton observed the Oneida Nation around Seneca Falls. And Matilda Jocelyn Gage not only encountered members of the Mohawk Nation, but was an honorary member of its Wolf Clan. These early activists saw firsthand that Haudenosaunee women could own property, initiate divorces, and perhaps most shocking, vote. It is especially grievous that this indigenous influence has been so thoroughly forgotten because suffragists mention the Haudenosaunee in their own writings and speeches. Some of these appear in Wagner's anthology, including, most strikingly, an 1875 article by Gage for the New York Evening Post called The Remnant of the Five Nations, and an 1891 address by Stanton before the National Council of Women called the Matriarchate, or Mother Age. The deliberative and participatory democracy of the Haudenosaunee was among the inspirations for the Founding Fathers when they wrote the Constitution. That living model also led the suffragists to believe that one day their cause could prevail. The modern world was indebted to the Matriarchate, Gage wrote, for its first conception of inherent rights, natural equality of condition, and the establishment of a civilized government upon this basis. On the strength of selections like these, together with the words of black activists, including Sarah Fortin and Fannie Williams, Wagner frames the women's suffrage movement as a revision of the history of suffrage as it was written by wealthy white women such as those Louisine Havemeyer knew. Susan Ware's Why They Marched, Untold Stories of the Women Who Fought for the Right to Vote, published by Harvard, accomplishes a similar goal with a different method. While Wagner uses primary sources, sermons, legislative documents, party platforms, poems, eulogies, diaries, entries, and letters to recover lost contributions to the women's suffrage movement, Ware's book is a work of material culture studies, which attempts to enliven the past by looking at the things that survive it. Ware pairs biographies of suffragists with objects like saddlebags, tree plaques, jewelry, political cartoons, parade programs, and statues. One of the last and most telling objects in Why They Marched is a handbill titled Seeing is Believing, which features three maps of the United States. The first is from 1869, when Wyoming was the only state that allowed women to vote. The second is from 1909, when after four decades, just three other states had enfranchised women: Colorado, Idaho, and Utah. The last, from 1919, shows a complicated patchwork of the various voting rights held by women around the country. By then, 15 states had passed constitutional amendments allowing full female suffrage. Others had partial suffrage, allowing women to vote in school or local elections. The handbill demonstrates the steady advance of women's suffrage while also complicating the standard portrait of it. The right to vote is less a switch than a dial, one that can be turned up or dimmed down. Three words appear beneath the last of those maps: finish the fight. The handbill was printed the year that the Susan B. Anthony Amendment was passed by both houses of Congress and sent to the 48 state capitals for consideration. The slogan was an exhortation not only for women who lacked the right to vote, but also for those who already had it, since ratification depended on a national coalition, drawing resources from suffrage strongholds and dispatching them to the expanding flanks of the movement. By the summer of 1920, suffragists had won 35 of the 36 states they needed in order to achieve the two-thirds majority required for amending the Constitution. They decided against trying in Vermont or Connecticut, where recalcitrant governors were refusing to call special sessions, or trying again in Virginia, Delaware, or Maryland, where the amendment had already been rejected, and they had given up entirely on much of the South. That left them with only one option: Tennessee. What happened in the Volunteer State is the subject of The Women's Hour, The Great Fight to Win the Vote, published by Viking, by the journalist Elaine Weiss. Once the battle came down to a single state, activists and lobbyists from around the country descended on Nashville, where they met old enemies and older arguments. Weiss renders the conflict so suspensefully that it's easy to see why Steven Spielberg's Amblin Television has already bought the rights to the book. The book grippingly recounts the twists and reversals that took place in the weeks leading up to the suffrage victory. But it is even more thrilling in its presentation of ideas, both those of the suffragists and those of the people who opposed them. The opponents invoked women's supposed emotional instability and intellectual deficiencies, the danger to society of anything that distracted them from their domestic duties as wives and mothers, and the threat to the moral order should they sully themselves with politics. Some argued that most women did not even want the right to vote. Others that the expanded electorate would be an expensive burden on municipalities. Still others praised the paradoxical objections that women would vote the way their husbands did, thus doubling their votes, or not vote the way their husbands did, thus canceling them out, making the whole thing a waste of time. As state after state allowed women to vote, the suffragists acquired more anecdotes and data that they could share in order to assuage the concerns of those who were not yet decided, and even change the minds of some who were. But while the sexist arguments that they faced often united suffragists around their cause, arguments about race divided them. Some of the very suffragists who worked to dispel ideas about their intellectual inferiority as women advanced similar ideas about the ostensibly lesser intelligence of people of color, and argued openly that only white women should be allowed to vote. a few acting on grudges that had lingered for decades following the exclusion of women from the Reconstruction Amendments, even posited that they deserved the right more than the black men who had already been enfranchised. These internecine conflicts marginalized the black men and women who were fighting for women's suffrage and kept the suffs fighting one another when they needed to be fighting antis, a powerful force whose numbers included many women. In Tennessee, the opposition was led by Josephine Pearson, who was drafted by her dying mother and emboldened by the certainty that her heavenly father wanted women to focus on causes more noble than politics. More surprising, perhaps, were some of her fellow travelers. The muckraker Ida Tarbell rejected her mother's suffragist politics and, despite her own successful career as a journalist, argued that women belonged in the home. Neither trousers nor ballots, she claimed, would ever make them equal to men. The founder of Barnard College, Annie Nathan Meyer, a sister of the suffragist Maud Nathan, believed it was disingenuous to suggest that women could ever purify the political realm with their votes. In trying to do so, Meyer insisted they forfeited their apolitical powers of persuasion. Plenty of seemingly progressive women were not activists for women's suffrage, including initially Eleanor Roosevelt, who did not vote in the first election for which she was eligible. Others disdained it entirely, like the anarchist Emma Goldman, who thought that all voting was a tool used by the powerful to distract the weak. In Tennessee, women on both sides of the debate lined the halls of the Capitol building, took over suites in the nearby Hotel Hermitage, and marched across the state to hound legislators, targeting even unlikely candidates to secure their support in advance of primary elections, which could alter the composition of the legislature before the ratification vote was held. Meanwhile, the railroad, liquor, and manufacturing lobbies went from sponsoring anti-suffrage activism to paying bribes to legislators as they grew increasingly afraid that enfranchised women would vote in favor of prohibition, labor reforms, and other progressive ideas. Arguably, the only people who enjoyed the summer of 1920 in Nashville were the florists, because the antis sported red noses while the suffs wore yellow ones, because the antis sported red roses while the suffs wore yellow ones. And soon there was hardly a lapel in the city without a flower. Personal convictions rarely accounted for a legislator's vote, and the politics of suffrage did not map evenly onto parties. The Republican minority, with its legacy of enfranchisement, promised the most reliable voting bloc in the legislature. But it was a Democratic governor, Albert Roberts, who called the special session and later announced his support for women's voting rights. If women did get the right to vote, both parties wanted credit, or at least the votes of the newly enfranchised women. Some Republicans opposed letting a Democratic state cast the deciding vote for ratification, while many Southern Democrats worried about shifting the racial balance of the electorate with 27 million new voters before the presidential election that fall. As ever, the debate over enfranchisement was not only or even mostly philosophical, it was primarily political, as both parties tried to calculate their own potential share of the new voting pool. Constitutional challenges and a legal campaign nearly kept Governor Roberts from summoning the legislators back to the Capitol, and there was even more chaos once the chambers were called to order. Weiss's book reaches a crescendo in the chapters devoted to the crazed weeks in August when the governor's closest ally, House Speaker Seth Walker, defected and announced that he would lead the opposition. Fabricated emergencies arrived by telephone and telegram as partisans tried to prevent legislators from voting by luring them away. And the newly named Republican presidential nominee, Warren Harding, muddied his already muddy position on suffrage with a letter giving cover for any cowards within his party. The Senate finally passed the resolution on Friday the 13th, but the House continued to stall, hoping to allow time for more defections to the side of the antis. The strategy backfired. on the eighth day of the session during a vote on another motion to table, the anti-representative Banks Turner switched his vote, allowing the amendment to go to the floor. And once it was there, the freshman member of Congress, Harry Byrne, switched his vote too. In a literal sense, we have our foremothers to thank for the vote. In the pocket beneath the anti-suffrage red rose that Harry wore into the chamber was a letter from his mother, Phoebe, pleading, quote, "Don't forget to be a good boy and help Mrs. Cat," end quote. Suffrage passed the Tennessee House of Representatives on August 18, 1920, with 46 nays and 50 ayes, including, perplexingly, an 11th-hour flip-flop from Speaker Walker, who still opposed suffrage but knew he could only attach a measure to reconsider if he was on the winning side. So well-paced is Weiss's book that, by the time she reveals that final vote tally, readers can be forgiven for having forgotten they knew all along that the 19th Amendment was going to be ratified. Apart from inaccuracy, one of the greatest flaws in any historical account is a sense of inevitability. That impression arises only when dissent has been so flattened, arguments so distorted, and the past so tamed that it fits sedately into the terms of the present. The idea that women were always going to get the right to vote in the United States ignores the reality that they only got that right in Switzerland in 1971 and in Saudi Arabia in 2015. It also fails to explain why the right was granted to American women in 1920 as opposed to 1919 or 1918, or perhaps more pointedly, 1776. Worse, the feeling of inevitability also conveys a sense of irreversibility, as if history always advances and never stalls or regresses. The woman's hour animates the past so fully that its facts feel anything but faded. Every victory appears both momentous and contingent, not only because Weiss takes the opposition to suffrage as seriously as the suffragists themselves, but because she lets the suffragists' own conflicts unfurl as messily as they did at the time, leaving readers to feel that things might well have turned out differently and reminding us that they still could. Not every struck match will light. And even when a fire finally catches, as it did for Louisine Havemeyer and the Silent Sentinels, it can just as easily dim into darkness or be snuffed out. The women of New Jersey knew that that could happen in the United States because it already had. And it is still happening as women of color in states such as Georgia and North Carolina understand all too well. These new histories suggest that the struggle for women's suffrage does not just extend further into the past than we thought. It also extends to the present and the future. The uncertainty of the suffrage victory foreshadows the precariousness of voting rights today, when even those who supposedly have the right are often prevented from exercising it. Disenfranchisement can take many forms, and its most insidious manifestations are regrettably common. Purging voter rolls, passing voter identification requirements, understaffing or closing polling places, gerrymandering voting districts. Under the circumstances, perhaps the best way to celebrate the anniversary of the passage of the 19th Amendment is to remember all those who cannot vote, not only those who can. And now, from the Talk of the Town section, the Drama Department, an essay entitled Mueller's Mouseketeers by Jeffrey Toobin. The pictures we carry in our heads of Disney, cheerful rodents, regal lions, long waits for the good rides, rarely include Robert S. Mueller III. But last week, a group of stars gathered at Riverside Church for a dramatization based on the special counsel's report. The playwright, Robert Schenkin, had distilled Mueller's doorstop into The Investigation, A Search for the Truth in 10 Acts, with the actors reading verbatim the evidence for each alleged obstruction of justice. financing for the endeavor came not from the Magic Kingdom, the Walt Disney Company, but from three Disney siblings who decided to collaborate on a project for the first time. My mother, who was not a Disney, was a great storyteller, but I'm an idealist, and I think that's the Disney side, Abigail Disney said at the after-party in the bowels of the church. She's been a successful filmmaker for some time, but in recent years has taken up progressive activism. She missed most of the Mueller play because she was at CNN advancing her crusade against insufficiently taxed wealth like her own. The show itself maintained the austere tone of the Mueller report. There was almost no political posturing, just the exact words that the prosecutor and his team composed. Walt Disney, along with most Disneys of earlier generations, was known as a political conservative. So is a fourth sibling of the three producers. Tim worked at the company for a few years, but his sisters never did. Abigail is unapologetic about using her name to bolster the causes she believes in. Disney is the last shameable company in the world because it's an emotional brand, she said. There's a lot of love in that brand, and people will always pay attention to it. Abigail credits her theme park patrimony with shaping her views. What's it's a small world except a little bit of a United Nations, she said. I think that ride set me up to do what I do. Well, we've run out of time for today's broadcast. I hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as I enjoyed reading it. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and/or print impaired. Today's broadcast, as well as all previous New Yorker readings, are available as podcasts at our website, triangleReadingService.org. For comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Well, that's it for today. Until next time, this is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.